Good morning. What are the realities of human trafficking today? We'll hear more about it, but it's nothing new, and Catherine Zian of the Pacific Alliance to Stop Slavery has a report from the front lines. And we'll get the legal perspective on government-to-government relations between the U.S. and Hawaiians moving forward. And an expert on early childhood development looks at ways to narrow the achievement gap. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Bill Sage. It may have started in 1926, maybe 1932, but whenever it did, the Aloha shirt has been synonymous with Hawaii for a long time, and with good reason. Aloha Shirts author Dale Hope joins us. And how do you party with an infant? Wait till she's a little older. Author Kawi Hart Hemmings will talk about the reasons behind a hilarious new novel.
It's Monday, September 26th, those conversations, and a few more after the news. Good morning and welcome to the conversation. And good morning, Bill, or perhaps I should say, yo.
Chris, all I can say on a wonderful Monday like that is, wish me luck, Chris, I'm going to need it.
This is the big one. You know, when the Associated Press reported last month that crew members aboard international fishing vessels that dock in Honolulu Harbor were kept in conditions comparable to slavery, many people were surprised. Catherine Zian of the Pacific Alliance to Stop Slavery was not one of them. For years, she's made the treatment of workers kept in involuntary servitude, whether on the streets of Honolulu or on the high seas, the focus of her work, and she's with us this morning. Good morning, Kathy.
Good morning, Chris.
You're one of the few people I know who actually has used that word frequently with regard to how people in our midst are treated.
Yeah, there's really no way else to describe it other than involuntary servitude or modern-day slavery.
Whose lives does that describe?
The workers, well, when we're talking about the longline fishing case, we're talking about undocumented, non-citizen mm-hmm. workers that come from various countries around Asia.
Which gives their employers the opportunity to do what?
Well, what's happening in Hawaii is that we see the abuse and perversion of the use of what's called the I-259 form, which is a deportation proceeding used by Customs Border Control to seemingly facilitate involuntary servitude of these hundreds of workers. Now, there's over 600 that we know about that are licensed fishermen in the state of Hawaii, yet they're technically in deportation proceedings. So when they get here, they cannot leave the boat. They don't know that when they sign up for the job, and they don't know how many hours they're going to be working. They don't know that sometimes they don't get paid. And that spells out basically a case of human trafficking, which we see in the latest news about a lawsuit being filed in federal court against a boat owner in the fishing industry here.
How long has this been going on?
This has been going on for decades, but very recently allowed the stamp of approval by the state, facilitated by our late Senator Dan Inouye.
You're talking about the change in the law that goes back to what, the 80s?
The 80s. This has been a culmination of efforts, lobbying efforts by the fishing industry, as well as our past lawmakers, to enable private industry in the fishing industry to use government agencies like CBP, or Customs Border Patrol, as their employment lackeys to ensure that their workers get the lowest pay and they can't get help for it.
I'm sure the language of the law doesn't use the term employment lackeys. What's its stated purpose?
Well, the I-259 is not supposed to be used for this purpose. It's not supposed to be used for profit. The I-259 is a deportation proceeding,
right?
Initially intended to protect our borders from people illegally entering the country, usually for malicious purposes.
This is how we deal with the terror threat. This is a tool dealing with the terror threat.
Yeah, it's a tool for national security, not for profit.
Yeah.
So what we're seeing is that it is this I-259 form that our State Department of Aquatic Resources allows to be shown as proof for the issuance of state fishing licenses, which is mind-boggling to me and several other advocates and attorneys.
I'm not sure I understand that. That's where they get that's where they're allowed to operate in local waters?
Right, yeah. So long as they never leave the boat and the captains are required to confiscate their passports. Now, these elements are actually elements of human trafficking.
Loss of your personal identity papers.
Yeah, as well as being confined to a small area, not able to leave. Now, these people are here not just for a few days or a few weeks. They're here for years.
Well, how do they get into it in the first place? What offers are made to them when they sign up?
As you know from other human trafficking cases, they're offered money, making a lot of money, a lot more money than they can in their home country. And they usually have a recruiter that is from their home country that offers them this deal, gives them a contract written in English. They can't read English, let alone some of them can't read at all because they're illiterate. But so they take the recruiter's word for it. So they don't know that they can't leave the boat when they get here. They don't know that they're technically in already, as soon as they get to the harbor, in deportation proceedings. They don't know that somebody else, i.e. the boat captains, are going to the State Department of Aquatic Resources and applying for fishing licenses on their behalf, which is, I think, an act of fraud. They don't know that they're going to get minimal pay, if paid at all. They don't know that sometimes they'll go without food. They don't know that they have to use the restroom either over the edge of the boat or in a bucket for days at a time.
How did you find out about this?
We found out about this because concerned citizens who were related to the workers from these countries now living in Hawaii on other visas like student visas and other sorts of visas were desperately trying to get help, going to federal law enforcement, going to individual attorneys, going to other agencies, getting the door slammed on them, or not having anything happen at all. So they came to us asking for help. And through a concerted effort of people not only in Hawaii but in other states, with the help of attorneys, experts in labor trafficking and maritime law, we all got together and tried to figure out what to do. We met with every single law enforcement agency on the federal level in the state of Hawaii to apprise them of this issue. And basically everybody had question marks over their heads because this structure that they're confined to, these federal law enforcement and government agencies, basically see on its face a legal system, but it's being applied illegally.
Presumably, these people you met with are good-intentioned people trying to work within the law. So I keep coming back to how does this happen? I mean, what you're talking about exists within a current legal framework, right?
Right, seemingly legal, yes. But the way it's being used, the way that it's being abused is highly exploitative, goes in direct conflict with other federal laws, such as our federal human smuggling law and our federal Trafficking Victims Protection Act.
Where do you see this going?
Well, the cat's out of the bag now, and there's a lot of wheels in motion on various fronts to basically provide these workers with protections and rights so that we could have a legal, fair labor fishing industry. There's no reason why Alaska can pay its crew members $80,000 for a season, and we can't do the same here and be a vibrant economy as well.
Well, we're clearly not going back to where we were, Kathy.
Absolutely not.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Catherine Zhan is the executive director and co-founder of the Pacific Alliance to Stop Slavery.
This is The Conversation on member-supported HPR2. It's 8:14. Coming up, Aloha Shirts, the inside story. But first, in the backyard, inside story on Hawaiian politics from a while ago.
Unihoa, ulan o mau o ka ho'olawe o Hawaii.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we remember a man who entered his name into contention for the Republican presidential nomination back in 1964, running as a so-called favorite son candidate. In doing so, he became the first Asian American to receive votes for president at a major party convention with the votes of the Hawaii and Alaska delegations. The nomination also made him the first ever Hawaii-born individual to run for president. He's the only Hawaii Republican ever to win a U.S. Senate seat, serving from 1959 to 1977. He was the first Asian American and the first Chinese American elected to the Senate, a lifelong public servant and businessman born in Kalihi in 1906. He went to local public schools and graduated from McKinley High School in 1924. He graduated from UH Manoa in 1930 and won a Harvard Law degree 5 years later. Rising rapidly in local politics, he became Speaker of the State House from 1948 to 1954, one of the most vocal and powerful advocates for statehood. And this morning, we're looking for his name. We hope he gave you enough clues. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. And the first one to get it right gets the T-shirt.
Support for The Conversation comes from Bank of Hawaii Private Banking, where a personal relationship manager and financial services team provide custom solutions. Learn more about Bank of Hawaii Private Banking at boh.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Our next guest was born in Honolulu, spent his life around the beach and the surf, and, of course, around Hawaii's garment industry. He inherited his parents' clothing business in his early 20s and bought the legendary Kahala name in 1986. He's the authority on Aloha shirts, got the first Governor's Cup for Hawaii Apparel Manufacturer of the Year in 1987, and he's spent his life spreading aloha and has just revised and republished his definitive book on Hawaii's iconic garment, the Aloha Shirt. And author Dale Hope joins us in studio this morning. Aloha, Dale.
Aloha, Bill. Good to be with you.
You too. So in 7 minutes or left, what's the story on Aloha Shirt?
I need 7 hours.
Stop. Put down your pencils. So to give it a start, there's a couple of conflicting. One person, the Young, suppose the Youngs did it in 26, and then somebody else claimed it in 32. It's almost like the Shaka. Where do we first find the Aloha shirt?
Well, the story goes that there was a guy named Young that did go to the University of Hawaii, and he would go downtown and get fabric that was Japanese print and take it to his mother's tailor shop and get shirts made, and he wore them at school. And then when he went off to college on the Northwest, he also took a lot of different Aloha shirts with him, and he was pretty much the first guy that you ever hear about doing that. Commercially, there was Ellery Chun. He went to Punahou, then he went on to Yale, came back to his father's dry goods store downtown, looked outside the window, changed the name of the Chinese store to King Smith, and would go out and buy fabric, have shirts made, and these were all in Japanese prints, and would sell them in his store. And he was a smart Chinese businessman, and he also had the name registered, Aloha Shirt. So he gets a lot of credit for being the first to ever commercially make Aloha shirts.
And one of the real seminal makers of fine quality, apparently, was he was known as Musashiya, the shirt maker.
Well, Musashiya was down the street, mm-hmm. and I got to meet with Mrs. Musashiya one day, and she reluctantly put me off for 6 months. When I finally got to go in and talk to her at her home in Makiki, she was pretty quiet for a bit, and then all of a sudden she said, "Hey, you know the movie actor John Barrymore? He wouldn't come in my shop, yeah? He wouldn't tell me he liked one shit. So, you know, I would make him the first Aloha shirt, you know, with a copy crepe kind fabric, yeah, but, you know the guy down the street?
Do you know the Pocky guy? He get all the credit, huh?
So, you know, Musa, she had a great story, too. And she made shirts for Shirley Temple. And there's pictures of Shirley Temple in 1935 wearing a Kabi crepe aloha shirt.
Kabi was the Japanese fabric.
Right.
And so, Musa, I still remember those ads in the paper back when our phone number was 79949. But Musa's number was 5854.
Even smaller.
Four-digit phone numbers. So it evolves through the years, and pretty soon, I mean, by the time the golden age, it just proliferated far beyond what people thought, just because folks from the mainland were coming and carrying them back.
You know, the visitors came here. They stayed in the Royal. They stayed in the Moana. They dipped their toe in the ocean, or they went for a canoe ride. They went out with the Beach Boys for surf lessons. They went with Woody Brown on a speedy catamaran, and they came in. They may have gotten a Lomi Lomi on top of a surfboard, and then at the end of the day, the Beach Boys played music for them on the ukulele as they watched the sunset, and they said, hey, you know, where do we go get one of those shirts? And the Beach Boys would hand walk them over to one of their favorite little tailor shops or retail stores and get them the aloha shirt. And that's really how it all started, with these guys having a wonderful day in Hawaii.
So one guy like Duke Hanamoku, for example?
Oh, exactly. Duke and all the guys, Panama Dave and Blue Makua, and all those guys would take steamboat. They would all take people over to their favorite tailor shop to get them either factory tailor-made, or they could buy them right off the rack right then.
We have to fast forward a bit just because of the constraints of time, but let's fast forward to a pretty legendary figure named Tommy Holmes and your desire to put down in writing about this book, The Aloha Shirt.
One day Tommy saw me downtown. He goes, help us, help us, help us. I want to do a book on aloha shirts. Can you help me out? Can you write down what I should do and who I should talk to? So I gave him a long list of who should be in the book and the kind of pretty much the chapterization as it is today. And he looked at it and he goes, oh, we're going to do this together. It's going to be a book by Hope and Holmes. Unfortunately, in 93, Tommy was paddling with Nappy and his crew out in the ocean. He had a heart attack, and we lost Tommy at age 47. So it was then pretty much my duty to see this book through.
So as you saw through the stuff you had gathered from your folks' legacy, your dad was a soldier in state after the war and started a garment factory, essentially?
Right. He was selling fabric to the industry, and then mm-hmm. somebody told him you make more money if you actually make it into finished garments. And so he got a little factory really down the street from your studio.
Makaloa.
And started making shirts and ladies' dresses.
So HBR is actually in Hawaii's garment district of the old days.
You're right in the middle of it.
You also were instrumental in getting the Aloha shirt on a postage stamp. Is that right?
Yeah, after I dedicated a year to working on this book and really learned everything I did, I thought that the Aloha shirt really would qualify to be a stamp. So we wrote letters to the Postmaster General, and that got hundreds of people to write those letters, and it took a long time, but we did get a stamp.
Wow. Well, with your enthusiasm and what this iconic shirt means, I think we're going to be having that wonderful garment around for at least another century, and I want to thank you so much for being with us this morning, Dale.
You bet, Bill. Aloha.
Aloha. Speaking of which, the Aloha shirt author Dale Hope was born in Honolulu, spent his life in and around Hawaii's garment industry, and he'll be speaking this Thursday night from 6 to 8 at Roberta Oaks in Chinatown and showing many classic images from his book. See our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation.
With a framework in place for the establishment of a government-to-government relationship between the United States and a unified Native Hawaiian government, the challenge, of course, is the creation of that government. U.S. Secretary of the Interior Sally Jewell said, quote, "This final rule provides the Native Hawaiian community with the opportunity to exercise self-determination, and as yet, an opportunity is all that it is. A lengthy legal process lies ahead, and we're asking Attorney Bill Mehiula to help us sort it out." Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, Chris.
Creation of a government is a fairly tall order, isn't it?
Yeah, it has been. I mean, Native Hawaiians haven't had a government for over 120 years.
What do you use as a template or framework, or where do you start?
Well, this final rule is actually one of the key steps that you need, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, what you need is Native Hawaiians to come together and decide that they want to put together a constitution. And then they have to, a majority of them have to ratify that constitution. And then you needed the federal government to say or create a process whereby they could recognize that constitution and the government that comes out of that constitution.
Who runs the, who guides that process?
Well, the rule actually sets forth the requirements for ratification, what is the minimum requirements in the constitution, and the process for recognition.
So that means what, a percentage of the population?
Yeah, they had some minimum requirements. Like, for example, they wanted to make sure that the majority of Native Hawaiians voted in favor of the constitution. Mm-hmm. And so they said that you have to have at least 30,000 Native Hawaiian votes, and of that, 9,000 had to be Hawaiian homeland beneficiaries.
How is that census determined? You know, who decides who those people are?
Well, I mean, you know, that's a challenge for Native Hawaiians to come together and decide what their ratification process is going to be. Mm-hmm. I mean, the rule is very clear that this is for Hawaiians to run themselves. They create their own constitution. They create their own ratification process. But they gave Native Hawaiians sort of the minimum requirements. If you want recognition, this is the sort of thing we're looking at. Mm-hmm. But it's for you to decide whether or not you want to create a government, and if that government is created, whether or not that government wants to be recognized by the federal government.
In order to hold elections, which I assume are going to have to be part of this process at some point, you need an entity.
Right, right. That's the ratification.
So,
right.
So who's the entity that decides what the entity is to become?
Yeah. Well, I noticed that you had Daviana McGregor on the show on Friday,
right.
And she was part of that AHA that created a constitution. Mm-hmm. So, you know, theoretically, Native Hawaiians could come together and hold a vote for ratification of that constitution. If that constitution is ratified by Native Hawaiians, then following that constitution, they could elect government officers. Those government officers could then decide whether or not they want to submit to the Department of the Interior for recognition.
Who decides who's Native Hawaiian?
Well, you know, the Constitution, part of self-determination is for the Native peoples to decide for themselves what the membership criteria is. And in that Constitution, that AHA Constitution, they basically say you have to be, you know, 1% Hawaiian. You have to be indigenous in the sense that you have to be a descendant of those peoples that lived in Hawaii before 1778.
How do you go about establishing that?
Well, you know, everyone has their own criteria, but in the DOI rules, they say that if you're a Kamehameha graduate, if you're on Hawaiian Homelands list, if your birth certificate says you're part Hawaiian, or if you just certify by swearing that you are Native Hawaiian and that you have a sponsor that is Native Hawaiian that says, yes, this person is Native Hawaiian, mm-hmm. then that qualifies also.
Is that potentially problematical?
Well, I mean, the fact that you've got a federal law that says that this meets the requirements, I think, is very helpful.
Yeah. So this is a definite step forward. I guess the next step is what remains in question, the exact next step.
Well, I think the next step, and Daviana talked about it, is that Native Hawaiians have to come together and decide if this is the constitution they want to seek ratification of, and if it is, then get together and have that process and have that vote and see if Native Hawaiians really want that.
I'm not sure how that would be determined, though.
Well, I mean, they have to have a ratification vote, and you know, you can do it a number of ways. You can create your own role. I mean, what the DOI rules say is that you can also use state developed roles. Mm-hmm. And which is really helpful, you know, because a lot of people would say, well, you can't do that because that's unconstitutional. But now you've got the federal government saying, no, that isn't unconstitutional.
It just seems to me possible, Bill, that different entities would want to control this process and that they might be in contention with one another at some point.
That's true. And I think that's the beauty of this process. What this process really drives at is Native Hawaiian unity. One of the requirements of the rule, this final rule, is that there can only be one Native Hawaiian governing entity.
Yeah.
And we want that governing entity to represent all Native Hawaiians. And so you can't have many of them. So the really it's, you know, what does the majority of Hawaiians want?
Well, you know, that's the first time I've heard it described as the beauty of the process, because it could also be seen as a major source of difficulty. Yeah.
Oh, well, you know, if the process isn't built that way, then no one's playing the game. Everyone's just speaking to themselves and saying that they're the leader, or they should be the leader, or that their system and theories are superior. Why not put it to a test and take it to the Native Hawaiian people and say, you know, this is what I have to offer. Vote for me. Vote for my system.
The process you just described, there's been a fair amount of that in the past, hasn't there?
There has. And I think that AHA was a really good example of that. I mean, we offered 200 candidates to go and sit down for 30 days and hash this out. 150, you know, took up the invitation. 120 actually showed up almost every day. Mm-hmm. And they got along well. I think what they found was that they all had the same thing in mind, and that is to further Native Hawaiian socioeconomic levels. And they all started to respect each other, and they came up with a constitution that over two-thirds of them voted in favor of.
This is going to go in some pretty interesting directions.
It is.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Chris.
Bill Mehiula is with the law firm of Sullivan Mehiula Lee, and his practice areas include Native Hawaiian rights.
HBR sustaining members are the heart of this station. They know their monthly gifts mean a steady, predictable income for it, and that we couldn't survive without them. Sustainers are a big part of the reason HBR can come to you daily, so please take the health and well-being of the station seriously and pledge $10 a month to keep your public radio station strong. Call us at 955-8821 or become a sustaining member at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Tory Richard Limited, celebrating 60 years of design for the island lifestyle. Tory Richard is proud to support local community news, public affairs, and talk programming on Hawaii Public Radio.
As questions about police misconduct and the Honolulu Police Department's attitude toward it continue to mount up, the police commission has studiously avoided controversy, leading some to question its commitment to its mission and the mayor's role in its deliberations. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has more in today's reality check. Good morning, Chad.
Good morning, Chris.
The picture that Nick Ruby paints is of a commission that's kind of, I guess you'd describe it as stagnant, yeah?
Well, Ron Takeda, who's currently the chair, won't even acknowledge that Chief Louis K. Aloha is under a criminal probe, a federal criminal probe, accusations of public corruption and abuse of power. Of course, the police commission is the very agency that's supposed to provide oversight of HPD. It is the only entity that can fire or hire a chief. So it is peculiar that Takeda is not even acknowledging this. And further along that same point, Mayor Kirk Caldwell hasn't decided whether to replace or reappoint Takeda, whose term actually expired 9 months ago.
And this, the criminal investigation of which he's in denial, is a matter of public record, right?
Oh, absolutely. There's many news reports and others that have talked about this. Not all the details have been forthcoming, but it's something that everybody has been talking about. You might remember a recent commissioner that was appointed, Loretta Sheehan, a former state and federal prosecutor, really had a lot of questions for K'Aloha and HPD in general at her first commission meeting not long ago. There's an example of a commissioner being aggressive, fighting arguably for the public's interest, trying to get at more information. Well, if HBD didn't have a strong problem with reports of police misconduct, maybe none of this would be necessary. But Mayor Caldwell refuses to talk to Civil Beat about this. Ron Takeda did not call us back at all. At least one critic, a UH professor, said this is inexcusable. Here's the mayor running for re-election and not talking about this major problem in the police commission.
Well, the police commission is supposed to be a somewhat independent entity, right?
That's correct. And I can tell you that the mayor has said publicly that he believes that Honolulu is a safe city and has supported HBD in general. But the question is there something else going on here? And several people that Nick talked to raised the specter of politics. Yes, to be cynical here, Chris, politics can play a role here. And you might remember that Ron Takeda is also head of the Hawaii Regional Council of Carpenters. Remember 4 years ago when Ben Cayetano was essentially smeared when he was running against Caldwell? Rail was the issue. Obviously, the Carpenters' strong supporters of rail. Cayetano was not. It's not clear how much of a factor that it is this time around, but Charles DeJoux, the mayor's current appointed, says the mayor is really being negligent, not really showing leadership. DeJoux himself has actually called for Kealoha to step aside while this investigation is going on.
Essentially, the police commission is supposed to operate without that much regard to what either the mayor or the police chief wants, right?
Absolutely. It's supposed to really respond to public safety, to the concerns of the community, to make sure that the HPD and its chief are doing its job. And there seems to be a hands-off approach. It wasn't long ago that the commission actually praised Kealoha's job performance.
Well, we'll be keeping an eye on this. Thanks a lot, Chad.
Thanks, Chris.
Every day we bring you a reality check with Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair.
And a quick announcement. Today's presidential debate will be immediately followed by special coverage by The Takeaway called Debate Rewind at 4:30 p.m. Hawaii time. That program will preempt tonight's edition of The Body Show.
And the more we learn about early childhood, the more important it becomes. Those years of intellectual and social development set us up for the rest of our lives, and when early childhood education is neglected, a world of human potential is lost. Ross Hunter, director of Washington State's Department of Early Learning, has seen too much of that. The focus of his message is the benefits to our entire society, providing the very best education to the very young. He's with us in our studio. Good morning, Ross.
Good morning. How are you?
All right. When you look at how education used to be done, there are innumerable young people who didn't get as far as they could have, right?
Oh, sure.
Looking back over our history.
Yeah.
And what's lost when that is lost, beyond the effect on individual lives?
Well, the effect on individual lives is pretty striking. The effect on the economic potential of your society is lost. You know, I look at Washington State, and our economy is totally driven by, right now, really the tech industry.
Sure.
Airplanes, the tech industry. We've got to have an educated workforce. That's our advantage in society.
Mm-hmm.
And if we've got half of our population not able to participate because they arrive in kindergarten 2 years behind and they never catch up, we see huge racial disparity. The outcomes for different ethnic groups are strikingly worse. Kids who are born, I would say, far from opportunity never get closer. And they don't contribute to our economy. The biggest problem that we have right now is talent attraction. And we've got kids growing up who could be that talent, who could grow our economy, and they're not able to do it.
Because that's not developed.
Right.
And it's not developed very early on.
That's right.
In the past, economies and educational systems were tailored to adapt to economies. Right. Hawaii had a plantation system and an educational system that was largely, let's say, pre-Second World War, geared toward feeding the workforce in the plantations.
Mm-hmm.
Is that accurate to say across the board in terms of American education, that when people were destined to work in factories, farms, stores, they were educated just enough?
So the growth in the world has required more and more education over time. And our education system in the past has been a system that selected, right? It was about sorting more than it was about developing talent.
You're college bound, you're not.
Yeah, and college bound was like 15%.
Right.
Well, that doesn't work. Yeah. If you look at, I graduated from college in the early 80s. So I was in high school in the 70s. I'm the Bruce Springsteen generation, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of kids my age sort of would go off to work in a steel mill or something.
Right.
And the return for those folks' economic growth has been terrible since then. And so how do we make a world where everybody's, where the rising tide really does lift all the boats rather than just the boats of the people who started out in nice boats at the beginning?
Yeah.
I mean, we just can't, it just doesn't work. So we've got to figure out how to have kids come in to kindergarten ready to be successful, because all of our experience shows that our K-12 system doesn't really narrow that gap. And we have a lot of evidence, real evidence from big experiments, not just some tiny little program 40 years ago. Places like New Jersey, places like Boston, big systems are doing work with low-income kids and are having striking success, and that success is carrying through into the elementary school grades. So the educational gains of those kids really are working all the way up into elementary school, which is as far as they've run the studies now.
When you say K-12 education, are you saying that kindergarten is too late?
No, I'm not saying it's too late. I'm saying it's strikingly expensive. The further down the curve you get, so you can do job training for people who weren't successful in school,
right?
And it works. It's just really expensive. You can do, and we're doing this in Washington, we're starting to think about how do we take our community college system and grow it so that people can get longer degrees. But when we're looking at first-generation college growers, we need this immense amount of support in order to enable people to be successful. That's expensive. Mm-hmm. Then you go sort of further upstream, you get to the K-12 system. A lot of research, and I'm happy to point to some detailed research on that. I spent most of the last 15 years working on school funding. We can improve outcomes for low-income kids, but in order to do that in the K-12 system, you have to fund it completely across the board, which means that it's just strikingly expensive. When you just keep going upstream and until you get to the problem and you say, wait a minute, these kids arrive in kindergarten two years different than these other kids, and they're vastly more likely to be children of color. They're vastly more likely to be low-income kids. If we can improve that, we can actually have those kids track together and be successful all the way through the K-12 system without having to do that huge investment in the K-12 system. It's a much more targeted use of money, and we have states that are doing it and are being successful at it.
As long as there are successful models to work from, there's hope, isn't there?
There's huge hope. Yeah. And we're seeing that where lots of states now are investing in early learning, in high-quality early. Because just doing it without focusing on the quality of what you're doing, without focusing on having a curriculum and having a theory of practice where your teachers know what kind of work works well for kids and what doesn't, if we're thoughtful and intentional about doing that, we can move the dial.
Great. Good to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me on.
Ross Hunter is the director of Washington State's Department of Early Learning. He's a former executive at Microsoft and a former state representative for Washington State's 48th Legislative District. He'll speak at the Hawaii Children's Action Network's Keiki Talk series Wednesday morning at 8 a.m. at the Pacific Club in downtown Honolulu.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Matson. Last year, donating to more than 600 nonprofits in Hawaii, the Pacific, and on the mainland, where its employees and their families work and live. More on Facebook or Matson.com.
helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of people.
It's just something that you want to do.
I wanted to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. There are still a few people around who remember boat days and Hawaii calls from the 1930s and 40s. For 20 years, the gala fundraiser Maui Calls has been recreating the spirit of aloha from those days, and many say it's contagious. In 1996, Honey Bun Haynes and co-chair Judy Biscard were asked by a distributor to host a wine symposium. The proceeds would go to support the Maui Arts and Cultural Center. Grand sommelier Chuck Faruya joined in, and he was followed by the best chefs on Maui. Then some hotels donated table service. The florists came next, and by the end of that summer, so much had been donated that an auction was set up. That was 20 years ago. Today, Maui Calls is the quintessential fundraising event on the island. Their guests say it feels like a trip back to the Banyan Terrace in the 1940s. You smell the flowers and hear the sea. A sense of kindness rubs off on you. You sip your wine and wonder when Webley Edwards is going to say,
"And here we meet again, beneath the mighty Moana banyan tree beside the sea."
Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you.
In this morning's Backyard Quiz, we remember the only Republican ever to win election to the U.S. Senate from Hawaii from 59 to 77. As an attorney with a Harvard Law degree, he founded a firm with partners Miho Choi and Robinson. During World War II, he was a major in the Army Air Forces as a judge advocate, later retired as a colonel from the Air Force Reserve. In 1952, he was part of the local hui that started Finance Factors, one of the first industrial and consumer loan companies to serve Hawaii's minority populations. By now, you might remember him by his name, Senator Hiram Fong.
And Bill, several people did call in, but Steve O'Hara of Honolulu was the first. He's the winner of today's Backyard Quiz, which got quite a few respondents. So thanks to everyone, and at 8:49, that's our quiz. If you've got one for us, do send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
When your hapai and the love of your life decides that the love of his life is someone else, and 2 years after your keiki's born, this former love of your life wants your child to be the flower girl at his wedding, to the one who isn't you, let's put it this way. In the Senior Academy at Punahou, the author of the new novel whose premise has just been described was thought of as keenly observant and very creative. It would be quite a treat to get inside such a very creative mind. And with her gracious permission, we're going to do just that this morning by phone with author Cowie Hart Hemmings. Aloha, Cowie. Good to talk to you again.
Hi. Nice to talk to you.
Okay, so everybody says write what you know, and the question has to be, you know this from experience?
I know some of it, as I do everything that I write about. But no, I did. I was very familiar with being a mom in San Francisco. I wasn't single, but I guess like so many moms, they feel single at some time, at some point when they're new mothers and their husbands are off at work. But no, I raised my daughter in San Francisco until she was about 3 years old. So I'm familiar with that culture and trying to make friends as a mom.
It's sort of alienating when your whole life revolves around the infant and then suddenly, I need to branch out or I'm going to go stark stirring bonkers. Is that pretty much the vibe that got you going?
That's the vibe. And also, you know, you want your child to have opportunities to socialize, and you're trying to find a way together in a new city, and it's probably a different feeling than moms feel here in Hawaii, where you either grew up here or you have family here, and some moms in cities probably feel a little alienated.
So in a sense, you're in the Bay Area, and you're ohana-less, and you're trying to establish your own ohana.
Correct.
So when you do that, what is the phrase, when I first heard helicopter moms, I had no idea what it meant. I came from a slightly earlier, gentler time when it was just aprika strollers and play dates, but things apparently fast-forwarded quite a bit. So what is this helicopter mom?
Well, a helicopter mom is a mom who's constantly hovering like a helicopter over their child. And you know, it always stems from good intentions, I'm sure. But from what I have learned, it's sort of good to let your child make mistakes and make their own choices without us constantly curating their lives. But I think a little bit of both is important, to be involved and yet, you know, back off a little and see what your kids will discover for themselves.
So this is sort of, even though it's in the guise of a cookbook, this is sort of your recipe for how to survive motherhood when the kids are young?
It is, and it's also just a fun story. Well, not entirely fun, but it's just about a story about a mom trying to find her way with her child and get over the loss of her, you know, the love of her life. And while it's not a manual on how to raise children, it's more about a mom trying to discover that for herself.
In effect, a manual on how to raise yourself up, where yeah. we might consider motherhood and the raising of children as truly coming of age.
Right. I mean, that's, you can't get any more coming of age than that. But
oh, go ahead.
No, but please don't read this book as a manual on how to party with an infant.
Oh, I certainly wouldn't do it that way. But I've everything you write, I have the idea you describe kind of as a, dare I say, on the radio, one sassy titter at some time, yeah?
I wouldn't say that. But
okay.
Yeah, I would say just, I observe things, and then I write them down.
And you've been doing that ever since you were a kid.
Right.
So with this sort of experience in mind, and you have this gift for observation that absolutely is hilarious to many, many people, and I'm sure you're going to keep going with many more observations as time goes on. One thing I'd like to find out, I hadn't even heard the term, but I noticed it sounded like a lot of girls seem to have this sort of scratchy problem with their voice, and I was wondering if, like, laryngitis is taking mm-hmm. over. And then I heard that this is supposed to be sexy?
Oh, I'm not sure.
But
I think it's...
we call it fry talk or some such thing?
Yeah, vocal fry.
Vocal fry.
I guess it's sort of just like an affectation.
What used to be valley girls are now frying.
Yeah, I guess that's, you know, we're constantly adapting. Who knows what will be next?
I'm just trying to, for the perspective, the way you stick it in with the comedy, the observation, it's something that appeals to me in the sense that I never knew about that, but generations keep evolving. As you keep your eyes set on the future, the eyes on the prize, so to speak, of every day is a new now,
mm-hmm.
What do you plan to come up with next? Is there something cooking in your very, very fertile creative brain right now?
Yeah, I'm constantly working, just, you know, like as anyone would at a job. And so I'm working on a novel now, just started it. And
any taste of what
we'll
it might
see where
be?
It goes.
Any taste or hints of what it is, or it's still kind of a secret project?
Oh, nothing secret. It's just I'm not, you know, who knows what it will be when I'm writing something. I don't know what it is or what the outcome will be, but I just finished another young adult book, so we'll see if that gets picked up or what edits I'll do to that, and then I'm just working on another adult novel.
I'm sure it will, and I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us again, Kawi.
Sure, thank you.
Alrighty. Aloha Aweho. Kawi Hart Hemmings is the author of House of Thieves, The Descendants, The Possibilities, Juniors, and How to Party with an Infant. See our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation, for more information.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, striving to increase awareness and treatment of kidney diseases affecting 1 in 7 Hawaii residents. Learn more at kidneyhi.org.
Bill, we really packed quite a bit into today's show. I'm exhausted.
I know what you mean, and I found out something I didn't know before. Now, maybe I could just learn about, like, you know, Freitag.
You got to keep up with those voices, I tell you.
I guess I have to. I'm just, be still, my quivering pharynx.
That's right. Bill Sage has been helping us out for the last couple of weeks. Bill, thanks. It's been great having you with us.
It's been a lot of fun.
And that's it for today. Up tomorrow, we'll check in with political junkie Ken Rudin.
Plus, we'll meet puppeteer Nick Nave.
And we'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments. The number is 808-792-8217. Email is talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post your comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation. Tweet us at HI Conversation or BKOZHBR.
If you missed any of the show or want a past one, find them on the Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for the Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Bill Sage.
And Beth Ann Kosovich will be back with us tomorrow. I'm Chris Vandercook. We'll meet you in the morning for more of the Conversation.